This is Audible.
Spycraft, the secret history of the CIA's spy techs from communism to Al-Qaeda. By Robert Wallace and H. Keith Melton, with Henry Robert Schlesinger. Narrated by David Drummond. Section 6, Fundamentals of Tradecraft. Author's Note by H. Keith Melton. As a young naval officer returning from service in Vietnam in the late 1960s, I continued my interest in the world of espionage. The exploits of famous spies were fascinating, but my engineer's curiosity focused on the more obscure topic of clandestine technology. Many books, almost all produced by non-technical writers, chronicled noteworthy spy cases, but rarely could I locate details about the gadgets used to secretly photograph documents, plant listening devices, and accomplish other amazing feats. I watched the James Bond movies of the era and wondered whether there were such gadgets in the real world, or was Q only part of movie magic? Finding the answers to these questions became a passion that has consumed the last 40 years of my life and led me on treasure hunts around the world. My quest began in Washington, D.C., and eventually required many trips to Russia, Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Great Britain, France, Israel, and into Asia and South America. Repeatedly, my travels took me to KGB headquarters in Moscow and to the Berlin study of Marcus Wolf, legendary head of the East German Intelligence Service, HVA. I became a regular guest of Walter Forzheimer, the late dean of intelligence bibliophiles and founder of CIA's Historical Intelligence Collection, and through him, a lifelong friend of his eventual successor, Hayden Peake, the noted historian, author, and intelligence bibliographer. Eventually, I discovered a commonality among all the world's spy agencies, that each selects its intelligence officers for the ability to recruit and manage agents, and not for their technological skills. Only rarely does an operations officer understand the technology inside the spy gear employed in secret operations. For this necessary technical assistance expertise and creativity, intelligence services created a cadre of specialists known as techs to support and, at times, even conduct the operational activity. Techs were usually recruited because they had pre-existing knowledge in fields such as photography, radios, electronics, chemistry, woodworking, fabrics, or communications. Techs working for the KGB, HVA, CIA, Mossad, MI6, DGSE, or DGI, shared a technical language. Each intelligence service had an internal component dedicated to examining espionage devices captured or recovered from its adversaries. Analysis of foreign finds could identify the originator of the gadget, provide new technology and techniques, and lead to countermeasures. Over time, many of the technical tools, regardless of the nationality of the service, began to look similar. Commonality of functions resulted in commonality of forms. In compiling my research, I also discovered that the fundamental work of clandestine intelligence could be grouped into five general categories, and within each grouping, technical support was critical. Photos and illustrations of spy gadgets used by various services appear in my previous books, Clandestine Warfare, 1988, OSS Special Weapons and Equipment, 1992, CIA Special Weapons and Equipment, 1993, The Ultimate Spy Book, 1996, and Ultimate Spy, 2003. Early in the preparation of this book, the authors faced the dilemma of using tradecraft terminology in the text without having space to provide a definition and explanation each time the term appeared. The solution has been for me to write a primer that draws together explanations of the essential technical terminology used throughout spycraft. In this 6-chapter section, I have attempted to integrate the gadgets with the doctrine of intelligence that lies behind their development and use. Chapters 20 through 24 describe the 5 pillars of tradecraft common to all intelligence operations. When merged with the clever devices created by innovative engineers, these pillars distinguish the professional intelligence services from those operations that are performed by quickly apprehended amateur spies. Chapter 25 summarizes the revolutionary changes that digital technology and a global internet have brought to each of the pillars. Chapter 20, Assessment. If one attempt in 50 is successful for recruitment, your efforts won't have been wasted. British turncoat and KGB spy Harold Kim Philby, as quoted in The Literary Spy, clandestine intelligence operations using human agents, whether conducted in the 18th century by America's Revolutionary War spy master, General George Washington, or in the 21st century by Islamic terrorists, have common characteristics. Five categories of recruitment and agent handling are so universal and fundamental that they can be called the pillars of tradecraft. These are assessment, cover and disguise, concealments, clandestine surveillance, covert communications. Depending on the stage of an operation, one of these disciplines will assume dominance, and every effort will be made to execute it flawlessly. For the Central Intelligence Agency, OTS had the responsibility to develop and support technical tools for each pillar that would provide U.S. officers and agents with a comparative advantage over their adversaries. Assessment is the first step in recruiting a spy, selecting the right target from among the thousands of individuals who could potentially help an intelligence service. Requires identifying the one or two with the motivation and ability to sustain the double life required by espionage. Sound tradecraft demands more than guesswork. Based on the experience OSS had with assessment and testing procedures, the CIA employed a small group of professionally credentialed psychologists to assist operations officers in winnowing the prospective recruitment pool and identifying the most vulnerable targets. Like their OSS predecessors, the psychologists of OTS employed a variety of assessment techniques and tests to gain insight into a target's dominant personality traits and potential behavioral responses to specific situations. Recruitment often encompassed months of patient cultivation by the case officer of a target before moving the contact into a clandestine handler-agent relationship. Infrequently, however, recruitment could occur during a 5-minute pitch in which an unsuspecting foreign official would be asked, "Would you work with the CIA?" Operational circumstances determined whether an individual was the subject of extended development or a cold pitch, but in either case, the assessment conducted before the question was asked loaded the dice in favor of the case officer. Assessments provide the CIA with a good sense of the target's likely reaction to a pitch and their long-term value to the CIA. However, under the best of conditions, acceptance of a pitch can never be assumed, and sound assessments will anticipate the possibility of an angry and hostile response. If the pitch goes well, an agent is recruited. If the recruitment offer is rejected, assessment will have provided information to minimize blowback and operational compromise. Motivations to become a spy are as complex and varied as human nature itself. Because of unpredictable individual differences and cultural variations among foreign officials identified for recruitment, identifying a target's dominant motivator to conduct espionage became the primary function of the operational psychologists. One grouping of motivations became known as the MICE model. MICE, the easy-to-remember acronym of money, ideology, coercion, and ego, describes cross-cultural characteristics that often translate into vulnerabilities that become a basis for recruitment. Money holds particular attraction to targets from countries whose culture places high social value on achievement, status, and material possessions. Ideology becomes a powerful incentive for individuals who hate the political or economic system which they cannot otherwise escape or oppose. Coercion represents a negative motivator that could be effective only in selective circumstances with particular personalities. Ego frequently motivates acts of espionage by individuals who believe their talents, capabilities, and importance go unrewarded by their employers or unrecognized by professional colleagues. CIA psychologists found three of the most significant indicators of a willingness to spy were split loyalties, potentially evidenced by extramarital affairs or intense dislike of a supervisor, narcissism, when seen as excessively self-absorbed, arrogant, and vain, and dissidence in parental relationships. Added to these were contributing circumstances such as failed careers, marriage problems, infidelity, and substance abuse. Seldom was there a single motivating factor, and most recruitments were based upon a combination of vulnerabilities. Clandestine audio operations became one of the most useful ways to gather unfiltered information about a target's private motivations in unguarded conversations with family and friends. CIA psychologists concluded that, for most agents, the susceptibility to recruitment and the willingness to act is the highest between ages of 35 and 45, a time of personal reevaluation and midlife crisis commonly experienced in many cultures. In addition to targets who were cold-pitched and those who were recruited after development, volunteers constituted a third pool of potential agents. Some of history's best spies have been volunteers. These individuals, also known as walk-ins, sought out an intelligence service to which they could offer their information or services. Volunteers are treated with caution because many have an exaggerated sense of the value of their information or are seeking an emotional thrill of becoming part of the espionage game. More significantly, volunteers could also be dangerous dangles or plants, controlled and directed by a rival intelligence service. If the bait of the dangle is accepted, the hostile service is in a position to run a double-agent operation to either acquire information about the sources, operational methods, targets, and technology of its rival, or feed false information to the enemy. Regardless of how a potential spy came to the attention of the CIA, recruitment occurred only after a favorable judgment was made about an individual's access, motivation, and ability to lead a clandestine existence. The process of evaluation that precedes the decision of whether or not to attempt to recruit a target is called assessment. Two questions are paramount when assessing a prospective agent. The first is, what access to information of intelligence value does this person have now or will have in the future? The level and value of an agent's access are determined through questioning, verification of whatever personal bona fides are presented, and evaluation of the initial information the source provides. An individual's official position, social or family contacts, career progression, skills, and the quality of information are all used to confirm the potential agent's level of access. When Aldrich Ames gave the Soviets the names of nearly a dozen active CIA agents in June 1985, his access was confirmed and a willingness to commit espionage demonstrated. When the National Security Agency evaluated Viktor Shamov's initial reporting in 1980 on Soviet communication security, the quality of information immediately established Shamov's access to exceptionally valuable intelligence. The Soviet and U.S. response to Ames and Shamov demonstrated the willingness of intelligence agencies to move quickly to recruit a volunteer without lengthy assessment when access to critically important intelligence was demonstrated. The second question considered by a recruiter is, can a prospective agent live the life of a spy and do what is required by the task of espionage? This assessment requires insights to predict, with reasonable accuracy, the future behavior of the target. Like buying an automobile, expectations and desired outcomes at the time of the initial transaction can sometimes trump reality. If either the automobile or the agent turns sour, the frustration and expense of owning a lemon can turn into disaster. Bringing professional skill and the tools of modern psychology to the process of assessing the situational behavior and personality of would-be spies, foreign leaders, and current agents became the core work of the OTS operational psychologists. From its beginning, OTS employed a staff of professional psychologists to conduct operational assessments of foreign targets. The assessments were based on the best psychological science available and used both commercial and specially designed psychological tests to evaluate a target's personality, motivation, and aptitude for clandestine work. Raw data for assessments was acquired from reports of operations officers who observed personal and behavioral traits of targets. The OTS psychologists then applied their expertise to evaluating all of the information gathered on the individual. The psychologists provided professional personality assessments of recruitment targets, individuals who volunteered to work with the CIA, and defectors. Depending on the specifics of the case, the assessments were used for guidance in building a relationship, refining a recruitment pitch, addressing agent handling problems, minimizing issues at agent termination, preparing for agent resettlement, and framing counterintelligence judgments about assets. The assessments were frequently combined with results of polygraph testing administered by the Office of Security for the fullest possible understanding of the subject. Defectors, whose bona fides were in question, such as the high-profile cases of Yuri Ivanovich Nosenko and Anatoly Golitsyn, were assessed by the TSD psychologists both to support counterintelligence analysis and to assist officers responsible for resettlement. These assessments could be either direct or indirect, depending on whether or not the psychologist could personally interact with the subject. When personal meetings were not possible, assessments relied on the psychologist's analysis and interpretation of credible secondary data. The most complete assessments included direct personal meetings between the OTS psychologist and the target. For security, these operational meetings usually employed various elements of clandestine tradecraft, including disguise, alias identity, and surveillance detection runs. Under normal circumstances, such meetings with the target were conducted in a manner that did not reveal either the psychologist's true profession or intended purpose. The psychologists conducted the assessments in whatever venues could be arranged for meeting with the target. In Germany during the mid-1980s, a leader of a terrorist cell had been an intermittent contact of a case officer, but little progress was made toward recruitment. The question of whether or not to continue recruitment operations against the individual came to OTS. Because the target frequented a nightclub that drew its patrons from the international community, an OTS psychologist was directed to make the nightclub part of her weekend activities. For her disguise, the psychologist chose a blonde bimbo look based on knowledge that the target's eye gravitated to every blonde that entered the club. On a particular Friday evening, the psychologist, with the assistance of disguise specialists, selected a slinky dress, put on a curly blonde wig, blue-tinted glasses, rosy pink lipstick, and blue eyeshadow. As she walked out of her office, the psychologist passed the chief secretary, offering the standard "Have a good weekend" greeting. The secretary looked up with surprise to ask, "Who are you? Have you signed in?" After a moment of silence, both found amusement and appreciation for the superior work of the OTS disguise officers. At the nightclub, the psychologist observed the movements and interaction of the target and put herself in a location to attract his notice. The ploy worked, and the two engaged in a conversation that moved quickly from introductory chit-chat to increasingly friendly banter. It was a good night for the psychologist, whose questions were so readily answered that she needed to periodically go to the powder room to jot notes and confirm that her disguise elements were in place. As the evening progressed, so did the personal level of their conversation. The terrorist, clearly enjoying the pursuit of his blonde prey, became increasingly familiar and uncomfortably suggestive with the psychologist. Seated in a dark corner of the nightclub, he leaned very close and whispered a well-practiced line, "I'd just like to run fingers through your blonde curly hair." The psychologist choked back the overwhelming urge to rip off the wig, hand it to the terrorist, and in her silkiest voice reply, "It's all yours, if you will stop annoying me now." A direct assessment might involve pretext testing or face-to-face interviews with targets. The target would be unaware of the true purpose of the interview, since the psychologist would be introduced by the case officer as a friend, colleague, or knowledgeable specialist about a common area of interest. Thereafter, the psychologist would observe and record the target's verbal skills, interaction with the case officer, body language, temperament, and other personality and behavioral characteristics. The unexpected usually became expected during the interviews. In support of an operational project with a cooperating service to build a new counterterrorism team, an OTS psychologist posed as the American official who would make the decision on members for the team. Over the course of several days, the psychologist administered assessment tests to several dozen candidates under the guise of the final interview. After the team members had been selected, several additional individuals were nominated to become office manager for the project. As the psychologist talked with a young woman about her interest in the office manager position, it became evident that the candidate had no applicable skills for the work. She could not type, claimed no previous work in an office environment, had never done filing, acted as a receptionist, or exhibited any knowledge of office procedures. The perplexed psychologist finally blurted the question, "Well, what are you good at?" "Hijacking airplanes," replied the applicant. Inquiries about office skills ended, and further questioning by the psychologist confirmed that the woman had been part of the planning and execution of 3 hijackings. She was reclassified from potential office worker to possible field operative. In situations that precluded personal interaction, OTS psychologists made discreet observations of targets at a distance. These could often be done during diplomatic receptions, social events, or while seated at an adjoining table in a restaurant. The evaluation of clandestine video or audio surveillance tapes of a target represented another quasi-direct assessment technique. These clandestine observations supported both operations for assessment of recruitment targets and collection of personality information on foreign leaders. A daring but ultimately abandoned plan for assessment by discreet observation occurred when Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev visited the United States in 1958. A TSS psychologist was directed to remain at his home on a specific day for a special assignment. The psychologist's residence adjoined an empty field, large enough for a helicopter landing area. When he saw a helicopter land in the field, he was to climb aboard for a ride to Camp David, where Khrushchev was scheduled to confer with President Eisenhower. Once at Camp David, the psychologist would be slipped into a closet in the room where the two heads of state were meeting. From a non-obvious peephole in the closet door, he was to observe the Soviet leader's demeanor, voice inflection, body language, and any other characteristic that might provide insight into his mental and psychological state. The psychologist waited throughout the day, but no helicopter appeared. In the tradition of need to know, no reason was ever given for scrubbing the operation. For personality and behavioral assessment, OTS selected psychological tests and procedures applicable to the target's position, nationality, prospective operational role, and relationship with the case officer. The tools OTS used for assessment testing fell into 3 classes: commercially available tests that measured intelligence, psychological characteristics, aptitude, interests, and personality traits; modified commercial tests that were adapted for particular operational purposes; and CIA proprietary in-house developed test and evaluation procedures. The CIA's primary direct assessment tool, a largely culturally neutral test, was developed by TSS psychologist John Gittinger in the 1950s. The test questions could be administered openly or covertly by a case officer or psychologist in any language, and the responses fed an assessment method named the Personality Assessment System, PAS. Gittinger, who joined the CIA in 1950, had developed his skills as the director of psychological services at the Oklahoma State Mental Hospital in Norman, Oklahoma. By interpreting data derived from patients tested against the Wechsler Intelligence Scale, Gittinger determined that he could make basic judgments about personality. He eventually collected Wechsler data on 29,000 subjects representing social groups ranging from hobos to fashion models and businessmen to students. He was an early user of computers for compiling large quantities of test data to develop comparative relationships. At the CIA, he refined the methodology and built a mature PAS model. By the time he retired in 1979, Gittinger's conscious emphasis on cross-cultural orientation for assessments and a demand for systematic, rigorous, research-based judgments had become the basis for the CIA's acceptance of operational psychology as a technical tool for agent operations. While Gittinger's system had detractors, ranging from those who thought all psychology was suspect to professional peers who questioned the methodology, the PAS proved valuable to case officers involved in operations where time for personal contact with their targets was limited. The PAS results were so strong that the test became the standard method for assessing and predicting agent motivation and situational behavior. The insight the OTS psychologists provided about foreign targets by interpreting data from the PAS earned them the nickname the Wizards. Indirect assessment involves reviewing all reporting from case officers about a target's personal history, behavior, demeanor, and reactions to his contact with the case officer. All information available from or about the target, including public and private speeches, publications, and letters, as well as news stories and commentary by associates or relatives, are factored in. Covert audio or video transcripts, when available, also become a valuable part of the assessment package. The psychologists apply accepted analytical tools to the material and conduct an internal peer review from staff colleagues with multicultural backgrounds and foreign language skills, in addition to their professional credentials. Direct assessments yielded higher quality and more extensive data for analysis than did indirect assessments, but the latter were necessary when the subject proved to be inaccessible. During the Cold War years, when many targets lived in countries with severe travel restrictions, OTS maintained a small staff of handwriting specialists called graphologists. Graphology, a discipline more respected in Europe than in the United States, seeks to identify psychological characteristics of an individual based on measurable letter formations and line strokes in handwriting. The graphologists measured three dimensions, the vertical, horizontal, and depth of strokes or letters, for as many as 21 different characteristics of writing. Handwriting analysis has demonstrated the ability to distinguish between mentally healthy persons and those with mental illness. The OTS graphologists applied the same methodology to identify essential characteristics of persons who are unidentified, would not agree to a structured assessment, such as VIPs, were writers of anonymous letters, or were held in captivity. Advocates asserted that by analysis of handwriting, which in graphology is called brain writing, psychological characteristics and personality traits important to the CIA on otherwise unknown people can be identified. Although psychologists disagree on the value of graphology as a standalone tool, many agency operational managers agreed that, as a supplement to direct assessment, or in the absence of direct assessment opportunities, handwriting analysis done by trained graphologists contributes valuable insight into a target's mental state. The best graphological analysis required a page or more of current handwriting for comparison against a similar amount of writing from some years earlier. Rarely did the graphologist have the luxury of being in possession of that much information, and at times had to lower his expectations of the science. When presented with a collection of Stalin's doodles after the dictator's meeting with U.S. diplomats in the early 1950s, one TSS graphologist declined to provide a current psychological assessment. The sketches were clearly depictions of wolves, the graphologist commented, but he could offer nothing more than conjecture as to how those reflected Stalin's mental state. In another instance, during the summer of 1983, a graphologist was given the handwriting signature of Soviet Communist Party General Secretary and former director of the KGB, Yuri Andropov. Comparing the recent signature with previous Andropov signatures, the graphologist concluded that the writer had an inflexible commitment to ideological ends and little interest in compromise. At a time when the U.S. government questioned whether Andropov represented a new, more Western type of Soviet leader and was uncertain whether his health would limit his tenure as the Soviet head of state, the graphologist added that the handwriting comparisons showed evidence of increasing stress and difficulty in controlling moods. Causes of the stress and the reaction could, she concluded, be related to physical health or pressure of the position, or both. In fact, and Dropov's subsequent policies did not demonstrate new flexibility, and less than 6 months later, he died.